Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. You know how people dream about finding buried treasure and how every so often somebody actually does? Well, this week, scientists revealed the discovery of a huge cache of early human-like fossils, a brand new species of human ancestor buried deep in a cave in South Africa. And you and I read about this in the headlines, but Aliyah Gertoff first heard about it like this.
I woke up one morning, checked my Facebook, and there was a post requesting small-bodied excavators who could drop everything at a moment's notice, come to South Africa, and they needed to be able to fit in tiny spaces. I was like, that describes me perfectly.
Anthropologist Aliyah Gertoff's life changed with that post. Today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, we'll find out about what this new discovery means and head inside that cave.
From the outside, the cave is not much to look at, honestly. It's just a hole in the ground. But as you descend, it becomes darker and darker. You begin to have to squeeze between the walls. And about 4 or 5 minutes into the cave, you come to the Superman crawl. Essentially like a little tube that you have to get through. And that opens up into an area where the only way to get where you're going is to crawl up a fallen ridge of stone called Dragon's Back. Dragon's Back is an appropriate name for it. It's narrow on both sides, so you have to place your feet very carefully or you'll slide off one way or the other. Once you get up Dragon's Back, you enter a fissure that drops 12 feet. Now, it's a very tight drop. What we're talking about is the choke point that required such small-bodied people. The narrowest point in that chute is about 7 inches.
Wait, 7 inches?
Yeah. Well, that's why most of the way down I was shimmying kind of with my head turned to the side. The first time I went into that cave, my heart was pounding. It was cool. The stones were a little bit damp, but it smells good. It smells like dirt, like just after a rain, that kind of dampness. And it smells ancient. And the only thing you're hearing is the swish of your coveralls, the scrape of your feet against stone or dirt, and the sound of your own breathing.
And after all that, finally, you get to the Dina Liddy chamber, and there are the bones.
It's hard not to resort to almost religious terminology when trying to describe that chamber. It did have a cathedral-like feeling, even though it was on a much smaller scale. The first time I went in, I could see hundreds of bones just lying on the surface. I can see little pearly teeth glinting here and there. And I never thought that I would get to work directly with hominins. They are so rare to have just hundreds of them lying there was exhilarating and shocking, really. You know, here I was in the presence, the final resting place of many of our ancient relatives.
Did it feel sacred?
Hmm.
I know you're a scientist, but still.
Yeah. Yes, to the extent that there is sacredness in science, that space was sacred.
So what does it feel like to have been one of only a handful of people to have seen one of the most extraordinary archaeological discoveries in history?
It was life-changing. It is life-changing, and I think in a lot of ways trying to describe it does put limits on it. You reduce it down to the narrow sense of certain words, and I have a hard time really doing that for what I felt.
Aliyah Gertoff was part of the team that excavated the fossilized bones of a brand new human ancestor, Homo naledi, found inside South Africa's Rising Star Cave outside Johannesburg. Aliyah is a doctoral student in anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she works with one of the lead scientists on the project, paleoanthropologist John Hawks. So what do all these new bones mean? Steve Paulson asked John to unpack the new find.
John, how important a discovery is this trove of ancient fossils in South Africa?
You know, when you think of a famous fossil discovery like Lucy, we're talking about an impressively complete skeleton. And in our terms, that means about 40% of the body is there in one way or another. For the Dinaletti chamber, we have 15 individuals, and we have very complete representation of all parts of the skeleton in multiple instances. So we're looking at something that is truly unparalleled in the African fossil record.
So does this discovery change our understanding of human evolution?
I can see at this point, right, we're 2 years in after the discovery of the bones initially, and we've done a lot of analysis. I have already changed a lot of my ideas about how our evolution went, and we're still learning what these bones have to tell us.
So what's changed for you in your understanding, your narrative that you've pieced together about our evolutionary history?
Maybe 15 years ago, certainly when I was a student, we thought that the transition from early hominins that we call Australopiths to our genus, Homo, was an event that was accompanied by a change in the way that we walk, a change in the way that we deal with culture. We started making artifacts. We developed technology. That change was tied to a change in diet. We got smaller teeth and we ate higher quality things. We shared food. We began to relate to groups of people in a tighter way with more cooperation. And that meant that the brain got bigger. And all of these things were closely linked to each other. And the fossil record, the archaeological record, seemed to support that. Looking at Homo naledi, its skull looks a lot like the skulls of other early Homo types of creatures, Homo habilis and Homo erectus, except it's too small. The brain hasn't increased in size in a way that humans have. It walked like us. Its feet are the most human aspects of its anatomy. It manipulated objects. We see that their hands were apparently well made to make things. And its teeth look like they were made for a high-quality diet. They're more human-like in some respects than Homo erectus, Homo habilis, for certain. But other parts of its anatomy are strikingly primitive. Its hips are Australopith-like. They look nothing like the hips we've attributed to Homo before. Its brain is so small, it tells us that these things that we thought went together as a package actually happened separately, and maybe in separate branches of our evolutionary tree.
Wow. So it sounds like you're saying we might have to rewrite this whole story.
It's very clear that the discoveries that we've made over the last 10 years have started to take apart this story that we thought was very tight and concise and has made it much more complicated.
Do we know if this new species you've discovered, Homo naledi, if it's a direct ancestor of us?
We don't know. Homo naledi is the right form to fit into our family tree somewhere around the time of the origin of Homo erectus or slightly earlier.
How long ago was Homo erectus?
Homo erectus lived from a beginning point around 1.6, 1.7 million years ago up until around 400,000 years ago or so. And so this would be around the beginning of that, maybe earlier, in terms of how its connection to us occurs. But we don't know the age of the fossils. We don't know if they are that old. They could have lived 100,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago. You know, they could have lived alongside modern humans, and we don't know it yet. Or they could be vastly older. You know, maybe they're the first evidence of a human-like creature. We literally do not know the date.
Wait, you're saying there's a possibility this species could be 50,000 years old. It could also be a million years old?
It could easily be a million, 2 million.
That's a huge difference.
And believe me, you know, for us, that's something that is, you know, that weighs on us, obviously. You know, we want to know how old it is. The trick in this case is that in South Africa, we usually depend on the caves to tell us how old things are. The bones of hominins are usually found along with bones of other animals. And the animals are extinct, so that tells us around the time that they, you know, lived was the time the fossil hominins lived. Also, they usually occur in hard cement-like rock called breccia, and that rock is cemented together with cave formations called flowstones, and we can usually develop an age estimate for the flowstones. The Dinaletti chamber, where we found these bones, does not preserve any other extinct animals in association with these hominins. So we can't look at the other creatures. There aren't any. And the bones are in a soft sediment, sort of like a clay. We use paintbrushes to excavate through it. So we don't yet have the flowstones that will tell us what age the fossils are.
Let me step back for a moment. I'm just curious about what this was like for you. I mean, you're one of the core scientists on this project. Was there a moment when you realized, oh my God, this is extraordinary?
You know, when we were working in the field, and I give Lee Berger all the credit for this. You know, he's the project director. We were in the field and bones were coming out of the cave. And you start to realize, wait a minute, there's not one skeleton as we might have imagined. You know, if we found one skeleton, that would be one of the most amazing discoveries ever. We have Lucy, a famous discovery. Why? Because there's a skeleton there. We started to say there are multiple ones. And we started to realize there aren't any non-human animals. This starts to look very funny. And suddenly it's like, wow, I have just jumped into the middle of something that is a discovery that will consume all of us for decades trying to figure it out.
So as far as you can tell, what would these individuals have looked like?
If you look at them from a distance, they would stand around the size of a very small human. So 4'6" to 5'. They would be thin for their height. Looking more closely, they stand very much like a human. Their feet are the most human-like aspect of them. They're clearly well-made for walking and walking in a human-like way. Their heads are very small. You know, you're looking at an ape-sized head, but an ape-sized head that's configured a bit more like a human's. And probably they would have had very powerful arms. We see that their thumbs are some of the most unique aspects of the skeletons because they have these very powerful bones that root their thumbs to their hands. You're looking at somebody that's sort of made for a tough lifestyle, but is slight and slender, you know, sort of like, if you imagine a lightweight wrestler in their build.
And what else distinguishes this new species?
We have this interesting view into their social life, I would say, because we have bodies of all ages. You know, we have a newborn, we have many children of different ages, we have an old adult. And of course, one of the most interesting aspects of it is that they are in this remote cave chamber by themselves. And we investigated that, you know, in every way that we could.
The question is,
yeah,
how do they get there?
Yeah, how do the bodies get in?
Right.
You know, today, the cave is twisty and turny underground. It's got very narrow passages that are hard to get through. And the chamber itself, where the bones are found, is accessible today only through this very narrow slot that you have to climb down. And it's a 30-foot climb. It's a tough place to get to. We don't know for sure that the cave in the past had the same contours as it does today. Caves change, they evolve. But we can show that this chamber was never open to the outside. That helps to explain the lack of other non-human creatures because they didn't have access to this.
So one theory that you're throwing out the window, basically, mm-hmm. is they didn't just accidentally fall in there to their death. I mean, you would find other animal remains.
Yeah, this is not a pit that they're falling into. You had to go through some cave distance to get to this place. And we would think, well, maybe, you know, there were carnivores that were using the cave and maybe they were dragging bodies in. We don't have any mark on any bone fragment that we have that is a tooth mark from a carnivore. In fact, the bones are pristine. We don't have fresh breaks on them.
So no evidence that they died violently either.
Yeah, there's nothing yet that suggests that they fell, that they were hurt, that they were dragged in.
They were placed there. I mean, that's what you're concluding, that dead bodies were probably moved to this chamber in the cave.
These bodies entered that chamber whole. And they entered it not all at once in one catastrophic flood or some kind of event. They entered it over some time. All right, you know, what are we left with? You know, at this point, we believe the most logical explanation is that Homo naledi did this, that they were bringing bodies to this place.
You're talking about some sort of burial site.
You know, that's a tough word for us. It is, because it's natural, right? It's natural to say, well, they respected this place. They were bringing the bodies there. They cared about it. It's some sort of burial. But as from the science side, of course, we don't know what they were thinking. The bodies were not intentionally placed in graves. So we try as much as we can to divorce it from human cultural cases that we immediately imagine. We know that these bodies were taken there by someone who knew this chamber and who did it repeatedly. that implies a kind of cultural knowledge that was shared with a group. And it implies some sort of recognition of mortality. Maybe that's all it implies.
Of course, the huge questions are, was this part of some religious ceremony? Was there some belief in an afterlife?
Yeah. And as an anthropologist, those are the things that most engage me. And it is important for us not to overinterpret. We don't know what Homo naledi knew.
Okay, so you're being a very good scientist here. You're being careful, rightly so.
Yeah.
But if you speculate, you have to be speculating about this. What's your best guess as to why these bodies were put there?
You know, my inclination is, after thinking about it really hard, is that on the one hand, it's simpler than you want it to be. We can't imagine that there was some sort of ceremony that we're talking. We're not talking about a religion in a human sense. We're not talking about something that we recognize as having the trappings of belief as humans have it. You know, I think we're not looking at that. On the other hand, you have ritualized in a very deliberate sense some kind of behavior that builds on that shared basis.
So you're talking about rituals, but you're reluctant to use the word religious along with that.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, we know it was repeated. It had importance of some kind. But we don't know that it was symbolic, that it had a component that was beyond the ordinary that required a belief, a communication system, the things that religion in humans is built on. We just don't know. And for me, it's certainly something that makes me really meditate about what were our ancestors doing? What were they thinking? And where was our place in this with creatures that had, in some respects, very human-like behaviors, but were not themselves humans?
John Hawks is a paleoanthropologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's one of the scientists who discovered the new species Homo naledi. By the way, he also told Steve Paulson that they've excavated 15 skeletons so far, but the story is just beginning because there's 3 to 4 times as much material inside that cave. So we, humans I mean, have been telling stories about our origins probably for as long as we've been here. And these may be stories about our past, but they tell us a lot about who we are today, who we'd like to be. Coming up, filmmaker Werner Herzog and science fiction writer Kim Stanley Robinson imagine our prehistoric alter egos. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International. The thing I always wonder when I look at one of those reconstructed faces of an early human ancestor is, what were they like? I mean, did people who lived 20 or 30,000 years ago think like we do? Did they sit around the campfire and tell stories or make jokes? We'll never know for sure. But one place where you can get a tiny glimpse inside the minds of our Stone Age relatives is those famous cave paintings in southern France, among them Chauvet, a cave that has captivated documentary filmmaker Werner Herzog.
I can put it in one single word: awe. You're just awestruck. 32,000 years ago, there were the very first paintings that we ever have. The next paintings come 15, 16, 17,000 years later that we know. So it's a sense of awe. The paintings in Chauvet Cave or in Lascaux in the south of France are so accomplished, and they are so modern and they are so lively that we can only step back and hold our breath and acknowledge this is us. You can clearly see this is the beginning of modern man. You feel that they have things they've painted and done, things that have passed on to us as a collective memory, a deep historical memory. For example, you've got a bison, a galloping bison, and the bison has 8 legs. And tens of thousands of years later, in old Nordic mythology, the horse of the main god Odin, named Sleipnir, is the fastest horse ever seen to anyone. And the horse is so fast because it has 8 legs. Or, for example, there's one strange painting at the lower part of a female body and a bison almost embracing it. And tens of thousands of years later, Picasso makes a series of paintings, Le Minotaur et la Femme, the bull and the woman. And it's very, very much alike, although, of course, Picasso had not seen Jouvet Cave. There are cultural memories passed on to us, and a sense of time that is staggering. For example, some reindeer unfinished in charcoal. And you can, through radiocarbon dating, you can pretty exactly define when this was made. And it's overpainted, finished and overpainted by, I think, a woolly mammoth. And now science has established that one painter started the reindeer and another painter completed it, and it was 5,000 years later. It's just staggering.
Werner Herzog. His documentary about the Chauvet paintings is called Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Now, someone else who's been inspired by the paintings in Chauvet is the novelist Kim Stanley Robinson. One of his most recent books is called Shaman. It's the story of a boy who's being groomed to become the spiritual leader of his clan 30,000 years ago. The book grew out of Robinson's kind of obsessive curiosity about our Stone Age ancestors, about their connection to the land, their spiritual beliefs, not to mention their encounters with their neighbors, the Neanderthals. Steve Paulson recently sat down with Robinson to find out why he's so interested in prehistory.
Stan, you are best known for your futuristic novels involving space travel, so your novel Shaman has surprised a lot of people since it's set in the Paleolithic period about 30,000 years ago. Is there a connection between this story and your science fiction?
Well, there kind of is. As a science fiction writer, the whole project seems to me to be fundamentally about what can human beings become in the future? Well, when you ask that question, then you have to immediately ask, well, what are we? And then when you ask what are we, you get into the problem of how did we become what we are. And that leads you to sociobiology and a vision of our evolutionary past. And I've always been interested, because of my backpacking and because of this discovery of the Iceman in the early 90s, frozen in a glacier between Italy and Austria with all of his gear. And his gear was just like my backpacking gear, except it was different materials. And so I had this very strong sense of that they were like us. And so I was interested in telling their stories, and then the discovery of the Chauvet Cave threw the whole community into disarray. The archaeologists suddenly realized that 32,000 years ago, the artwork was just as fine. Lascaux is 17,000 years old, so the notion that we started primitive and got better and better at things was at least pushed way, way back.
I did get a chance to visit a couple of the painted caves in southwest France a couple of years ago. And the thing that is astonishing is the level of artistry there. I mean, not all of it, but some of it. I mean, if there's one thing that cuts across this chasm of time, it's that. They couldn't have been that different from us.
Yes. Well, now we know so much more. We know that genetically they weren't even the slightest bit different than us, except they might not have had lactose tolerance. Other than that, it's our genetic code exactly. So it's us. And I would propose to you that they were also high-tech. The technology that they didn't have that made them the most different from us is they didn't have writing. So everything was transmitted orally. And when I understood that, I was even more amazed. How did they keep a stable culture generation in, generation out for thousands of years when they were just telling each other stories? There was nothing written down. Well, maybe that's the secret. Maybe telling stabilized a culture. I don't know. I never solved that mystery. But it did completely change the writing of this book. I suddenly realized this is somebody talking. This is not writing. This is talking.
So your book, Shaman, is the story of this boy on the cusp of manhood, Loon, who is being groomed to be his pack's next shaman, and he goes off on what you call a wander. What is that?
Well, I took that from the Aboriginal walkabout. So that the first people's cultures in Australia had the habit of young men, when they reached their initiation rite, essentially their bar mitzvah, would be sent out for a period of time to live alone in the wilderness as a test of survival, but also a chance of reordering their mind when they come back, they're an adult.
And to set this up, it's still kind of winterish. He is stripped naked.
Yeah.
And he's got to survive. Yeah. And right away, he's got to find a way to get warm. He's got to fend off lions and bears. Quite a task.
Well, yes, extremely dangerous. When there's big things, predators like lions, and not just lions, but cave lions, which were like half again as big as our lions.
Now, there is another kind of encounter that Loon has in this wander. He comes across a few Neanderthals.
Yes.
Who hunt him. You have a great passage early in the book where you describe that first encounter. Could you read that?
Yes. A sniff gave him the answer he most feared, a waft of smoke and grease almost like his own smell, but different. Old ones. They smelled different than people. Thorne had forced this knowledge on him once when they had come upon a dead old one, lying in one of the shallow cliffs downstream in the gorge. Thorne had grabbed the dead one's bearskin cape and held the collar of it to Loon's nose. Lunkheads always smell like this, Thorne had said, flicking him hard on the ear. Now Loon was sweating from his face and palms. The day had suddenly become one of his nightmares. Stories about boys on their wanders being eaten by old ones had always seemed just like stories. All the men Loon knew had come back from their wanders. And if you ran into an old one, they always seemed about as harmless as any woodsman. But woodsmen could be dangerous. And the old ones were burly people, as strong as bears or wolverines. One of Thorne's stories told how an old one had married a bear by mistake, and neither of them had noticed. They definitely knew how to hunt. Their spears were stout, made for thrusting and short throws. They were experts at ambush. That was their way. When they were in pairs or trios, one would sneak around while the other watched from a blind. They hid better than any other animals. Even humans.
So we know that there was a period of at least a few thousand years when humans and Neanderthals coexisted in Europe.
Yes.
There's been a huge amount of speculation about how they got along. How do you imagine this relationship between humans and Neanderthals?
Well, it was long and complex because it was actually many thousands of years probably because the Neanderthals were in Europe already, well established when the humans arrived. And so we're talking a coexistence of the two in the same landscape for maybe 20,000 years. And we throw these numbers around, but 20,000 years is a long time. Mm-hmm. And the great prehistoric novel, I would say, is The Inheritors by William Golding, in which Homo sapiens is seen as these murderous, incomprehensible killers that come into a very simple-minded species of Neanderthal. And so he wrote it from the Neanderthal point of view. And it is another Golding extraordinary achievement. What a wonderful writer, brilliantly good at evoking strangeness. So I'm glad I didn't write a Neanderthal novel because it's really already been done.
Do you sort of accept that scenario that humans are kind of the killers and Neanderthals were
well,
perhaps a little more innocent?
No, it's just speculative, but there's nothing that can disprove it. I mean, even now that we've learned that, you know, something like 2 to 5% of our DNA is Neanderthal DNA, so there was sex going on between the two species that actually had offspring that was viable. We know this because we can read it right off of our own DNA. So in other words, it's such a complicated picture that it supports my idea that most of these archaeological statements are science fictions. You take a tiny bit of data, and it's a history that you can never know, and then you write a story about it, and then you can either say, well, this is my theory, or you can say this is my novel. But it just probably depends what genre you write it in, whether it's an article or whether it's a story. But it's always a story that you tell that you make up from a limited amount of data.
And one of the things that's so striking about your novel, Shaman, is there is the whole shamanic tradition as well of getting in touch with some other reality. I mean, your young character, Loon, as part of his wander early on, he ingests some mushrooms that obviously have some mind-altering effect. He sees some terrifying creature that has the head of a lion, horns. What do we make of that?
Well, you see in the shamanic tradition, I mean, mostly in South America, but really everywhere, this idea that you get outside yourself, you do something, and it could just be staying up all night and or dancing, music, drum beats, sleep deprivation, flailing yourself, running for super long distances, etc., where you get into an altered mental state, and including various plants, artemisia and various psychotropic plants. And the evidence comes out of not just the shaman cultures that are still alive today, where you see people still doing it, but also on the cave walls, the abstract patterns that are sort of in the entryways, like they're the beginning of the trip. And they're also the abstract patterns that it is claimed by some scientists, and I can't swear to this personally, are exactly what everybody would see when they are coming onto certain psychotropic drugs. I'm interested. I was a California hippie. You know, I discovered the Sierra Nevada, Buddhism, science fiction, poetry, and psychedelics all at the same time. And so I've never come back from that moment. It was a permanent changer of my reality when I was, say, 20 years old, and I think all to the good, basically.
So you've had what we would call mystical experiences.
Well, I wonder. I guess so. I've had religious experiences. I've had a sense of the sacred. I've had the very strong feeling that I'm wandering in a sacred landscape and that I am part of it. And so if you call that a mystical experience, yes. And not only that, but that does not need psychotropic drugs to achieve. You just go up there in the winter in the Sierra Nevada and start walking around and start hiking hard. And at a certain point, it comes down on you. And essentially, it's a space you go into that can last for days. That's the real finding. And this is more Zen than it is hippie psychedelia. This, the idea that once you're paying attention to a landscape that you're in an altered state of consciousness. Suddenly an hour is like a week, or it's very hard to characterize what an hour is because maybe it passes and it feels like a second, but it also feels like a week. You lose that sense of normal clock time. This is a very valuable mental space.
That's Kim Stanley Robinson talking with Steve Paulson about his novel, Shaman. You know, kids love thinking about cavemen and women, too. If you had to drag yourself to elementary school every day, wouldn't you fantasize about living outdoors in the wild? Well, kids today can thank Michelle Paver for putting some teeth into their fantasies. She's the author of a best-selling series of children's books called Chronicles of Ancient Darkness. They tell the story of 12-year-old Torak and his companion Wolf as they struggle to survive in the forest of Stone Age Europe. And to write them, Paver not only studied anthropology, she also went and lived with the Inuit in Alaska and the Sami in Lapland. She says she's been thinking about this for a long time.
It goes back to before I could read. My parents had a great big book of beautiful, very accurate illustrations of life in the Stone Age, which I still have. And I used to lie on my tummy in the sitting room and just look at these. And I wanted to do that. And when I grew a little older, when I was 10, I wanted to live like the Stone Age people. So I got rid of my bed and slept on the floor, and I saved up my pocket money, and I bought a rabbit, a dead rabbit from the butcher's, and I took it to the garage and I skinned it because I wanted to make clothes. Of course, it was a little bunny, so it wasn't big enough. But and my parents were brilliant. They let me do this sort of thing. I wanted a wolf as well. There they drew the line. But that, I think, it's the childhood idea of, you know, building your own shelter and making your clothes out of animals, and I suppose not going to school, that had a large part to do with it.
So it sounds like your fascination with the prehistoric world goes way, way back to childhood. But what is it about that period of time that appeals to you today as a writer?
Well, I couldn't have predicted it, really, because when at the time of looking to start the first book, Wolf Brother, I thought, well, you know, I just want to write an adventure story. It'll be set in the Stone Age because that's going to be exciting. And then I wanted to make it real. I mean, that the point was I wanted to make the reader, whether they're 10 or 15, really feel that they're having the adventure. So I thought, well, I better find out what it's like, did some archaeological research, and then the whole thing snowballed from there because I realised that I just, by accident really, or because of my childhood, I'd chosen this incredibly interesting time because the hunter-gatherers think differently from us. And of course, The big one was, if you kill an animal, which you have to do, I don't think there were any vegetarians in the Stone Age, if you kill an animal, you've really got to treat it with respect and not waste any part of it, because that would be showing disrespect to the powers that rule the forest, and then maybe they wouldn't send any more animals, and then you die. And so in the first book, Wolf Brother, Torak, you know, he's been orphaned by this bear, and so he's got to kill his first deer and take it to bits and use everything. And I know, as a 10-year-old, I would have loved that. It's just fascinating.
Michelle, if you could go back in time, 6,000 years to the time of Torak and his friends, what questions would you have that you would want answered?
Oh, goodness. Oh, gosh, I've never been asked that before. I'm usually asked sort of, would you want to go back in time? Of course, the answer is yes, but for only a short period of time. What would I ask them?
I guess I'm curious about what big mysteries remain about our human ancestors.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, of course, we don't really know what they looked like. Obviously, they looked, you know, in sort of physical terms like you or me, but the very few bodies we found have had tattoos on them. I mean, there was this famous, I think he's sort of been nicknamed Iceman. He's about 5,500 years old, who was found on the sort of border between Italy and Switzerland. He had some tattoos on him, and that gave me the idea for the clan tattoos. I'd love to see how they looked, because I think most of the evidence is that, you know, people take a lot of trouble with their appearances. I don't think they would have been any different. And the other great thing, of course, is their stories. What stories did they tell? I've tried to make up stories for them, really. You know, that Torak's journey from Wolf Brother when he's a young lad of 12 to fighting the Soul Eaters, the forces of evil, all the way through to Ghost Hunter, is really a cycle of 6 books of him discovering his world. You know, he goes to the sea in the far north and then to the mountains in Ghost Hunter. And I've kind of created, I hope, a sort of legend for the Stone Age people, the hunter-gatherers. But what stories did they tell? Because, of course, for them, the world was old. You know, it stretched back thousands of years, and they probably had their own sort of canon of stories. So I think, really, the great mystery for me as a storyteller would be to ask them to tell me some stories. That would be fascinating. Sit round the fire with their greatest storyteller, or their clan mage, whoever, and hear them telling their stories.
Michelle Paver is the author of a series of children's books called The Chronicles of Ancient Darkness. That's it for our conversation about ancient human history, but coming up, we'll remember 9/11 and the battles that followed with one of the world's greatest living war photographers. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. A lot of people think James Noctway is one of the world's greatest living war photographers. For more than 3 decades, he's covered just about every major armed conflict or crisis on the planet. He's been injured in the line of work. Just last year, he was shot while covering pre-election violence in Thailand. He's won dozens of awards. He's even been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize 10 times. Now, the Courier Museum in Manchester, New Hampshire, has opened an exhibition of James Noctway's photos. It's called Witness to History, and it documents his work in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the place those wars began, Ground Zero. James was on the ground on 9/11, taking pictures from the heart of the scene.
I lived not far from it. I could see it from my window. When I saw the first tower smoking, I thought it was an accident, but an accident of that magnitude at the World Trade Center was obviously going to be very important, so I began to assemble my camera gear. While I was doing that, there was a kind of vibration in the air and my windows rattled, and I looked out my window again, saw that the second tower was burning, and understood immediately that we'd been attacked and the United States was now at war.
And what did you do? You went out into the street, and as everybody was running away, you started running toward the scene?
Well, that's what I do, exactly. That would be part of my job description. I got there before either of the towers fell, And I was framing both towers burning when the South Tower collapsed. And there's a picture in the show that depicts that moment.
Yeah, let's talk about that one. There are no people in that photograph, but it's kind of terrifying. I mean, you should describe it.
Well, in the foreground, there's a cross. It's a cross of a church that was about a block and a half away from the South Tower. And I understood that this was an attack by al-Qaeda. I knew enough about our contemporary history. I'd worked enough in Afghanistan to feel that that was no doubt the case. And I just saw that the cross is, a symbol of our culture. So I framed it that way. It wasn't such a brilliant thing to do, but it seemed obvious to me. And as I was photographing, the tower collapsed, and it was, hard to believe. I was seeing it with my own eyes. Those steel girders that you see flying through the air like matchsticks are huge. I don't know how many hundreds, if not thousands of pounds each. Gigantic pieces of metal and sides of the building were flying through the air, as well as a kind of confetti of tens of thousands of pieces of paper that had been inside filing cabinets. Somehow my mind literally clicked into slow motion. And all of this was just floating towards me so slowly, I thought I had all the time in the world to make the frame. And only I was shooting film. There were 36 frames on a roll of film as opposed to digital, which has many more. Mm. I got to the last frame when I shot that picture, and that stopped me because I knew I had to change film. And in stopping me, everything went back into normal motion, and I realized I was about to get taken out. And I had a few seconds to take cover in the lee of buildings on the other side of the street from where I was standing, and all of the wreckage sort of fell over me.
The photo that haunts me is the one of the firefighters at Ground Zero. All you see is rubble, huge building, and a firefighter kind of in silhouette. And there's no obvious carnage. There are no close-up faces to carry emotion, but it's unforgettable. What makes it such a powerful photograph, do you think?
The scale of that fireman against the amount of wreckage was staggering. Everyone who was on the scene was on a kind of autopilot because it was so shocking. I think everyone just did what they knew how to do. I mean, bringing out fire hoses was of no value whatsoever, but that's what firemen do, so that's what they did. As a photographer, I could have been paralyzed with disbelief, but my job is to document visually, and that's what I did. But it's still hard to believe. I looked at the picture yesterday, and it was hard to believe. I've actually never gotten over it.
I've read some of the things you said about why you chose to become a photojournalist in the first place. I think it goes way back to, you were a student in the 1960s. Vietnam War was happening, civil rights protests, and the photographs taken at the time, you felt really changed history.
Photographers were telling us one thing, and our political and military leaders were telling us something else. And I found the work of the photographers to be more convincing. And when I finally decided what I wanted to do with my life, that's what I decided I wanted to do. I wanted to be part of that tradition. I saw that pictures could not only record history, in some way they help change the course of history. They become an element in the process of change.
So the role of the war photographer is a crucial one to a democracy, I guess.
I think it's absolutely necessary. I think that the stories we tell are vital for society to function properly. How can citizens make proper decisions unless they know what's going on? Journalism is vital, and I think the particular role that photography plays is that it can make a human connection, help people see something that is universal, that transcends culture, that transcends nationality, religion, race, and is just simply human. You're witnessing something that's happening to an individual.
It's funny, the stereotype of the war photographer is the adrenaline junkie. Sounds like that's not at all what it's about for you.
Adrenaline is a fact, but it's not a reason. You know, there probably are some what you would call war junkies out there, but I don't think they're the ones who continue for very long, and perhaps they're not the ones who make the most meaningful pictures. I think, you know, it's part of it, but there's this much more deep reason for pursuing this profession than adrenaline.
How do you deal with being in the places you've been, seeing the kind of suffering you've seen? I imagine one way of dealing with it would be to wall it off when you're working, to just suppress your own reactions until later. But I'm wondering whether that's changed a bit for you over the years. I mean, whether you found ways to either to open up a bit more, to actually work with and use your emotions, or do they just get in the way?
No, the emotions are natural. You have to channel them. You have to use them. You have to channel them into the work. If I were to see things and not feel emotions, then I wouldn't make pictures that were worth much. I'm the one who has to feel it first if I'm going to make anyone else feel something. So it's never been the case, and it's simply not the case that photographers go someplace and wall themselves off. Our job is actually quite the opposite. Our job is to go someplace and open ourselves up and leave ourselves vulnerable and feel those things and put it into our work so that we can translate it and pass it on to the viewers.
Hmm. You're making me think about another photo in this exhibition. It's one of an Afghan woman, I think. She's completely covered in a burqa, and she's kneeling on the ground in a graveyard. You can't even see her face, but the grief is just palpable. Where was that taken? Who is she?
It was taken in a cemetery in Kabul in 1996, and she was there mourning her brother who'd been killed in a Taliban rocket attack. At that time, the Taliban had surrounded Kabul and were shelling and rocketing daily. I think the graveyard itself is expressive. It's so humble, bare, cracked earth with uncarved, kind of raw stone. And her hand, her aged, weathered hand that had seen a hard life, reaching out, touching the stone, as if that's as close as she could get to her brother. What you don't get from the picture is the sound she was making as she was grieving for her brother. She was singing a kind of song in this very grief-stricken voice. It was very moving.
I'm just thinking about how hard it must be for you to be there to feel that much grief and then, you know, multiply that over and over again. You've taken photos of injured children and vets who are returning and painfully rehabbing themselves. People, at the moment, they're being shot or about to be shot. I don't know. What do you do with the grief?
You carry it with you. Nothing is forgotten. And I guess you have to carry it with you with as much grace as you possibly can. You know, again, as opposed to the stereotype, rather than getting hardened to it, I find that I get more and more sensitized to it, and it gets actually more difficult to witness such things, not less difficult. And it's just something you have to bear.
Do you still believe in the goodness of humans?
Oh, absolutely. I've seen so much goodness come out of the most horrible situations, so much generosity and hospitality. You know, I can't help but be moved and humbled by it. There's a very large installation. It's about 32 feet long. It's one single file, one single print. And it's a composite of 60 images that were all made in combat field hospitals during the war in Iraq. And it's pictures that show lives being saved. It's called The Sacrifice.
You've been there yourself, right? I mean, you've been shot. Weren't you injured in a grenade attack?
I'd been covering a single platoon for Time magazine, and I was with Mike Weisskopf, a Time reporter, and a grenade was thrown into the Humvee, and Mike had his hand blown off, and I got injured with shrapnel, and a couple of the soldiers got pretty badly hurt. So I was taken to that very same medical facility and medevaced out to Germany.
Were you still taking photographs while you were injured?
Until I passed out, yes.
Wow. Why do you keep going back?
I have a lot of experience. I still see that there's a reason as much as ever to do it. And I guess I do it because I can.
James Noctway. A new exhibition of his work just opened at the Currier Museum in Manchester, New Hampshire. He's the recipient of the Dresden International Peace Prize, the Ted Prize, and he's the subject of the documentary War Photographer. You can see some of the photos we talked about on our website at ttbook.org. That's it for our show today, but there's more in our podcast feed. To sign up, just visit iTunes or Stitcher and search for To the Best of Our Knowledge. And don't forget to leave a review. That helps other people find the show, and plus we like knowing what you think. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Craig Ely, Raymond Tungekar, Charles Monroe Kane, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.